I'm a member of the Usual Suspects group of Cocaine Anonymous in Augusta, Georgia. It's the best Cocaine Anonymous group in the country, and I hope you feel that same way about your group. We meet on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock in Augusta, and if you're ever up that way, we'd love to have you come visit us. We're a big book group. We believe in the directions in the first 164 pages of the big book. And so I'm tasked tonight, according to the big book, in a couple of different places. It tells me very clearly what I'm supposed to do. My favorite one is on page 50, and it says, in our personal stories, you'll find a wide variation of the way each teller approaches and conceives of a power greater than himself. So that's what I'm going to try to do tonight. I woke up on January the 15th of 2019 in an all-men's treatment facility outside of Augusta, Georgia, in the middle of the woods. And I was not unfamiliar with this facility because I'd been there two previous times, once in 2001 and once in 2016. And when I woke up that morning in 2019, I woke up that day sober. I wasn't sober the day before when I checked in, and I woke up real, real sick and dying in like 150 pounds. And when I woke up that morning, I was also a guy who knew what the 12 steps and the directions in the big book could do for somebody's life, because 6 years prior, I had walked away from a decade of sobriety. And I had two children who were 9 and 7 at the time who'd never seen their daddy take a drink. I had a nice career and a home, and I had this father that I hated, man. And when I was a year sober through that stretch of sobriety, I got this phone call, and the voice on the other end of the phone was just crying and crackling, and it was that father that I hated. And he said, son, I need you to tell me how you stay sober. And I was able to go visit him in Louisville, Kentucky, and he got into a long-term treatment facility, and he got sober, and I got to share my AA story at all 5 of his AA anniversaries in Louisville before he died. And so I woke up that morning with all of that going on, right? And super aggravated. I'm like, what am I going to learn? I had at one point more sobriety than anybody on this property, blah, 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 blah. And I got in this meeting and somebody read the set-aside prayer. And I said, boy, that's what I need to do. I need to set aside some of the old ideas that I got and try to have a new experience. And so I started to do that, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time, I don't think, talking about what it was like, because y'all know what it was like. I'll tell you what it was like. I broke everybody's heart who cared about me. I destroyed everything that was good and worthwhile in my life. I was a liar and a cheat and a user of people and a taker of things. And man, and it just destroyed my life and my family and my... You know, there was a point in my life before I got sober the first time, my mom had joined this organization for family members. Maybe y'all have heard of it. It's called Al-Anon. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know what that was, but I woke up one morning in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, with a blood alcohol level of 0.17, handcuffed to a hospital bed. And I had no idea where I had been, what happened. If somebody was dead, I knew I had some broken ribs and a fractured bone right here under my eye. And I called my mom and I said, hey, I need $500. She said, Jay, I'm not going to be able to help you this time. And I was 27 years old when that happened, and she had never said that to me in my life. I'm fortunate I come from my parents weren't rich by any stretch of the imagination, but they just threw money at the problem. They didn't know what to do. They just threw money at it. And they moved me all over the country, Steamboat Springs, Colorado, Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They paid for 3 universities that I never got a single credit at. And so when I called her that morning and she said, hey, I'm not going to be able to help you this time, I was like, maybe 300. Maybe I can get by on 300. 250? 100? She was like, Jay, I'm a member of Al-Anon. I'm helping myself. You're going to have to help yourself now. And I was like, I don't even know what that means. And I wasn't sure what Al-Anon was, but I'm sure as hell going to find out. I don't know if y'all know the difference between an Al-Anon and a terrorist, but you can negotiate with the terrorist. So I went back to Greenville, South Carolina. I was running around, and I ended up in this little apartment. This is only war story I'm going to tell you. And I was in this little apartment, the bed folded up into the wall, and I was shooting a lot of cocaine and drinking a lot of whiskey. And the Al-Anons met in this church right next door to this apartment complex. They met on Friday nights, and I knew what they did is they sat over there and they told my mama not to give me any more money, and if she could find out where I was, to call the police and tell them where I was because I had a warrant for my arrest. And so I decided I was going to go over there and tell them they were really cramping my style, right? And, you know, I got good and tuned up, right? And I stormed in the back doors of this church, and there was a fella standing at a podium. He had on a tie, and it was Monday night. It was the AA meeting. And I don't know if you've ever stormed in the back of an AA meeting, like on a 3-day run, but you got to ask for help at that point, whether you want it or not. And so I asked this guy named Richard, because I'd been a general nuisance around AA in this community for a while. So I asked this guy, Richard, man, I need some help. And he said, well, I'll get Bob and let's go over to your house and we'll flush all that garbage down the toilet. And here we go, another drastic proposal from Alcoholics Anonymous at the time. And I thought, nah, what? Look, man, you probably need to be in that meeting, Richard. So I'll go back to the apartment and you come over after the meeting and I'll have all that stuff gone. Nobody will have to throw anything away, right? We don't have to waste anything. And they never came over. And what I found out that night was what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization felt like. I was drinking Gilby's vodka and Kool-Aid. And, I couldn't hold it down. I could hit my stomach and throw it up. And I had to get a drink down. And so I started to take those needles and fill them up with vodka and shoot it in my veins. And I can't stop. I do not know how to stop. And my life just goes on and on and on like that. And eventually I get sober and the things happen and I build this life in sobriety, right? And I get married and I have these two beautiful children. And my dad gets sober and AA heals this relationship, this hate. This, I'm talking about like Emily's shirt, red hate. Just hate that I had for this father of mine, right? And AA heals that thing, and I'm like 7 years sober, and I got this sponsor who'd been sober longer than I'd been on the planet, and he spoke all over the country, and he would take me with him, and so they started to ask me to talk in places, and at this time, I'm a 29, 30-year-old kid, right? I'd never done anything with my life other than follow the Grateful Dead and widespread panic around the country and spend my parents' money. That's all I had ever done. I had no sense of, like, anything. So when somebody from the recovery community called me and said, hey, we're going to buy you a plane ticket. We want to fly you to Iowa, and we want you to stand up behind some podium in front of a bunch of people and run your mouth, I thought I had arrived. And so I had this wife at home who was in recovery and these two little kids, and I was always gone behind some spiritual nonsense, right? On page 19 in the big book, it says, a much more important demonstration of these principles lies before me at home. The very first place, then at work, then in my affairs. Guess what? These are my affairs. What I'm doing right now. I'm away from somebody I love at home and three children. Took the time to come 3 hours away, right? And we had a conversation about it, and she was going to come, and some things came up, and she couldn't be here. So I'm not ignoring her to be here with you guys tonight. But at 7 years sober, my wife said, we need to go see marriage counselor. And I said, okay. So we go to this marriage counselor's office, and we're sitting in there, and the marriage counselor asked me to write a letter and bring it back the next week about what I think is happening in my marriage. And so I heard some rumblings around my home group, right? And I write this letter, and I go back the next week, and the letter read something like this. I think Kimberly's having an affair with Scott. I think she's horrified to tell me that she's having an affair with Scott because Scott lives in a halfway house. Scott doesn't have a driver's license, and I'm Scott's sponsor. And that is, in fact, what was happening. And so I stayed sober for the next 2 years, almost 3 years, on sheer ego and pride. And I will show you, right? And I would come in the meeting, and everybody in that home group was like, Jay, you're doing so great. I don't know how you're handling this and staying sober. We're so proud of you. Then I would leave the meeting and I would go to the house that they were living in together. And one night I smashed the windows out on one of the cars with the golf club, which was my car. One night I spit in her face. One night I screamed and cussed out one of his young children. And then I go back to the AA meeting. Mr. Sober, Mr. Spiritual, nobody ever saw that, right? And eventually, I was in Atlanta, Georgia one night on a business trip, and just like the big book talks about, suddenly, the thought crossed my mind. And that's exactly how it happened. And this was the thought, right? I'm just going to drink tonight. I'm not going to tell anybody. That was it. Nothing more. Walked across the street from the Marriott Marquis in downtown Atlanta. Told this pretty blonde bartender to bring me a shot of brown whiskey before I changed my mind. And I drank it. And the next 6 years of my life was a revolving door of get 11 months, get 6 months, get 90 days, get 30 days, get 5 minutes. I left my home group over that next 6 year period with less sobriety than I had when I got there 50 times. Easy. I couldn't sit in that room and look at the 10 guys that I used to sponsor who had 3 years more sober than I had. Now, it was just my ego couldn't handle it. And eventually, a buddy of mine overdosed at the end of 2018, and they asked me to. This guy was sober with this guy for years, and his brother was 20 years sober, and this funeral was going to be like Alcoholics Anonymous in Greenville, South Carolina, representing in this funeral, right? And his daughter, I'd known her since she was a little girl, and she said, "I can't think of anybody else that Daddy would want to talk at his funeral but you." And I'm 150 pounds, strung out as I can be and dying. And I got to go into a room full of AA people who I'd been sober with for years and try to act like I got it together, right? And I met this guy in 2001 at a place called the Bridges of Hope. And it's where I met this guy. And I called my buddy at the Bridges of Hope, this guy named Roscoe, and he's just a friend of mine. I didn't call him trying to go back there or nothing. I just said, "Hey, man, I got to give this talk at this funeral. And I don't know if I can get through it. I'm really upset and shook up." And he said, "You sound kind of manic, Jay. Like, your mama sent me a picture of you the other day. You look like crap, too." And I thought, oh, God, man. I thought she was in Al-Anon. They're not supposed to do that. And so I find some Adderall, and I got to write this speech, right, to give at this funeral. And my buddy Andy really liked Ice House. So I figured I would get some tall boy ice houses, eat a few of these Adderall, and by a few, I mean like the whole bottle. And because that shit helps you concentrate, right? And so I concentrate on this speech. I like to call it the Ice House Adderall speech. And I write this fantastic eulogy, and I get up at the church, and I'm the first person who has to get up and talk. And I get up there, and the casket's right down here in front of the podium, and it's open. And you guys ever have an experience where like spirit comes and you say something and you're like, spirit goes. And then you're like, wonder who said that? What happened? Like all of a sudden you're not there anymore, right? And so I get up and I got this fantastic speech, by the way, guys. It was great. It was a great, great eulogy. And I get up there, man, and Roscoe had called me right before the funeral. And he said, "Hey, man, I can't make it, but I got a present for you. Why don't you come back down here and spend 6 months with me?" He said, "I don't need you to bring any money. I don't need you to do nothing. Pack a bag and just come." And I was like, man, I'd been to treatment 5 times before this in my life, always to keep a job or to get out of some charges. Now, I still had this pretty big time corporate job at the time, and I didn't have any charges. But I couldn't shake this idea that this opportunity to go to this place where I met this guy is coming up on the day of his funeral. I just couldn't shake that. So I get the speech out, and as I'm pulling the speech out, I look down, and his eyes were open in the casket. It was super creepy. And I said, "Hey, man," or I'm sorry, his eyes were closed. They weren't open. that would have been really creepy. And it was creepy enough that the casket's open. I'm not a fan of open caskets. And I said, "Hey, man, I see that your eyes are closed, but my eyes have been opened. I got the opportunity to go back to the treatment center we met and try to get a new life, and I think that's what I'm going to do. May the four winds blow you safely home." And I sat down. And when I sat down, I thought, oh, damn. Did I just tell this whole room full of AA people that I could go to treatment for free after this funeral? And I was like, oh, how am I going to get out of this? I had like 50 rides to treatment. Like, as soon as the service was over, everybody's like, "Hey, man, we're going to pack your bags. Let's go to treatment." And there was this AA conference in Myrtle Beach that coming up weekend. This was on a Thursday, and there was an AA conference called the Gratitude Retreat that my original sponsor had started and I used to be a big part of, and it was going to be the first year they had that conference without Sterling. And the committee was all at that funeral, and they were friends of mine, and I was like, man, Sterling would not want this to happen without me being there. like, we could postpone treatment till Monday. Like, it'll be fine. I'm going to be with all of you fine AA people all weekend. And all I was trying to do was buy some time till Monday. I had a big commission check coming. And so I got enough, you know, I managed to just go to this AA conference and stay well enough not to be sick. And I don't know if you've ever spent the weekend at an AA conference just trying not to be dope sick. It was horrible. But on Monday, I got this big commission check, and I sent some money to my kid's mom, and I gave my mom some money, and I packed two suitcases, and my mom came back in the room, and she said, "What are you doing?" And I had one with winter clothes and one with summer clothes, and I said, "Man, I'm going, and I don't know when I'm coming back. I'm just going to go, and when they tell me to leave, that's when I'm going to leave." And then I went and gave the rest of the money to the dope man. I owed him some money, and I went and paid him. And I bought some more dope because I wasn't sure that I was actually going to stay sober or even stay there. And if I was going to come home on a whim, right, I didn't want to owe the dope man any money when I was coming back. So I get there, man, and they make me the laundry man, right? It's like 70-man facility. Now, the laundry man is not a bad gig because it's the only – they give you a little money, you know. But I'm out behind the laundry shed one day, and the executive director comes to town every so often, right, to this facility, and he would bring his laundry. And he would, like, drop it off at the laundry shed with hangers and stuff, and I was just super pissed. I was like, "Are you kidding me right now?" I was so offended that this dude wanted me to wash his clothes and hang him up on a – and spirit's funny, man. It does funny things. And so – it dawns on me that I'm super pissed off at this man who's allowing me to be at this facility for free and wants me to, like, do a load of laundry for him. And I start to think about how ridiculous that is. And here's what happened. Here's where the shift happened for me, right? I was given this thought. Now, it sounded like me in my head, right? It was my voice. But the thought didn't come from me. And what the thought was simply this. "Jay, how much more evidence do you need that I want you sober?" I was 44 years old. It was my sixth time in treatment. I'd walked away from 10 years of sobriety at one point in my life. I don't know how many times I'd been to detox. My family still somewhat supported me. I still had this big corporate job I could have gone back to if I wanted to, if I chose to do that. And from that thought... they've been harassing me too, by the way, about doing this third step, right? They like to rush through this whole, like, process of the first three steps. And they were like, "We need to do this third step prayer. Jay, you need to pray the third step prayer. If you want to, you can put it in your own words. You know what the big book says." And they're harassing me about it. I'm like, "Y'all just, I got to decide, dude. Can I lay it all at the altar?" Right? This is what I was thinking about. Can I lay it all at the altar at step three? All of it. What if I don't get the job? What if the job fires me? What if the kids don't come back? What if I can't go back to Greenville? What if I got to stay in Georgia? All, and I had to get to a spot where I was ready to lay all that down at the altar of step three. And I had that thought, and I walked inside that laundry shed, and I grabbed a black magic marker, and I defaced the treatment center's property, and I wrote step one. I can't seem to fix me no matter how hard I try. Step two. There's got to be something out there. I'm at least willing to believe that. Step three. Okay, God, show me what you got. And it's still on there today. I was just out of that actual treatment center last night leading the big book study. And that was my third step prayer. That was it. The book says the wording is, of course, quite optional. Right? And so let me tell you what's God shown me since that day. I got to write some inventory, right? Y'all want to guess what I got to write about? I already told you. I got one thing to write about. I got some other stuff I need to write about too, but I got one thing I got to write about. And so I write the inventory, and I'm reading the inventory. My buddy Brandon, this guy named Brandon, just come out to this treatment facility, and he and I connected. And I'm reading the inventory to him, and I'm reading the inventory about this affair and blah, 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 blah. And he said, "Jay, how bad do you need to be right?" And I said, "Dude, I don't need to be right. I am right." And the goosebumps that I have under this sweater right now are the same ones I had when I said that to him almost 3.5 years ago. Because I heard myself say it out loud. And I knew enough about recovery to know, damn, I got to go make amends to this dude. Because I had slandered this guy's name all over Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the last 6 years, I had put all kinds of undue pressure on this man where my children were concerned. They never tried to take me back to court. They never tried to do anything about the custody of the kids. All their mother said to me was, Jay, you're one of the best people I know in recovery. Just get sober again. I got the kids till you can get yourself together. And I start working on these amends, and I have this old belief system, right, that you can't make amends while you're in treatment. And this is the belief system I'm operating with at the time. And they send me home on pass after 90 days, and they're like, don't come back here without making these two amends, these two specific ones. And they were easy. I thought they were going to be easy ones. One of them was take my company credit card and my company computer back to the job that I left, and just took their card and their computer and brought it with me to treatment in the middle of the woods 3 hours away, and didn't tell them where I was going. Actually, I left them a note in my desk drawer. And so I got to go meet this guy and give this stuff back. And I get there, I make an appointment and tell him what I'm trying to do. And I get there, and the girl at the front desk said, oh, he's not here. And I said, oh man, it says some people can't be seen. We write him an honest letter. I'm going to go out here to the car. I'm going to write him a letter. And I write this quick little letter out in the car, and I walk back in to give it to the receptionist. And she goes, oh, he's back there. He's in his office. And so I go back there, man, and I tell this guy, hey, man, I stole time from you. I lied to you the day you took me to take a drug test. And I said, oh, I got this emergency at my house. I need to run by my house. It was because I had some clean urine at my house, and I needed to go there before I went to the, you know, and I owned my part and asked him what I could do to make it right. Did he need me to tell him how I made it feel? This is kind of the way I've been taught to make amends. Like, here's the harms I'm clear on. Did I leave anything out? Do you need to tell me how that makes you feel? Which is a crappy question, by the way. I'm not a big fan of asking that. And then the final and the actual amends is, what can I do to make this right? There is no I'm sorry involved. There is no apology, right? If I'm going to amend something, I need to fix it. And I don't get to decide how to fix it. I also don't get to decide if this harms myself or others. The other people get to decide that. If I make the approach in the right way and it's going to harm them, they will say, no, I do not want to talk to you about this. And so I diligently start working on these amends, right? And I start making these amends, and I make amends to these kids, right? And I got to go make amends to these two children who grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? They literally grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. My son was 15 years old at the time. He's like 6'1" now. He's way bigger than me. He'd thrown me up against the wall one night, grabbed me by the collar and slammed me up against the wall. And he said, what the fuck is wrong with you? And I didn't have an answer for him. Now, this same kid, when he was 5 years old and we were walking out of my home group one night, and he was in the babysitter's room, and he said, Daddy, what do you do in those meetings? And I said, they teach me how to be a good daddy. And he said, will you tell them next week that they're doing a good job? And now the same kid has me slammed up against the wall, pinned up against the wall like he wants to kill me. And so I got to make amends for this. And by this point, this guy, Brandon, who some of y'all know, is screaming at people about the big book and woo-hooing and hollering and way too much energy for me sometimes. But man, we connected, and he said, man, you would be fantastic working in the treatment industry, man. Would you consider doing that? And I said, man, I got this corporate job and these kids in Greenville. And I gave him like 10 other things that I said. And he was like, whoa, 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 whoa. I didn't ask you any of that. It was like a yes or no question. Yes, I'd be willing to. No, I'm not willing to. I said, well, maybe, yeah, I'd be willing to. All right, well, send your resume to this guy. And so I send my resume to this place, and it's called Bluff in Augusta, Georgia. And I'm thinking, how does a guy who's in treatment get a job at a treatment center? Like, it just didn't make sense to me. And so the Bridges of Hope, that's where I was in treatment, and they drive me to the treatment center drives me to the treatment center for the job interview. And they offer me a job on the spot as a behavior tech. And I said, oh, I appreciate the offer. Let me think about it. I'll get back to you. Because I'm a good businessman, right? You don't accept the job right on the spot. Like, I don't have a house. I don't have anywhere to live. I've turned in my company credit card and my computer, and I need to think about it. And Oh, man. So anyway, I start there, and they want me to go back to school and do some stuff. And over the last 3 years, I've done all those things. But I got to make amends to these kids. And now I've got to make amends to them and let them know that I'm not coming home. And I sit down with my son, and I own my part in the things that I've done. And I said, you know, Kearns, they want me to stay in Augusta, and I got this opportunity to work in the recovery field, and maybe I can help some people. And maybe if you decide you want to come down there and live with me, you can, but I understand you're in the 10th grade, and I'm not going to try to make you switch schools. And he said, Dad, me and Breeley will be okay. We love you. Go down there and help some people. Go down there and help some people. And I've been able to do that. And I got to make amends to this guy, right? My son's 15th birthday party, and he says, Dad, you know what I want for my birthday? I want me and you and Mimi and Mom and Scott and everybody to go out to dinner. And I'm like, okay, wherever possible, right? And so I said, hey, Scott, man, can you come out here for a minute? I'm going to talk to you about something. Go out there, and we have a conversation. And I said, hey, man, I slandered your name all over Alcoholics Anonymous in Greenville, South Carolina, and from behind some podiums on a microphone that were getting recorded. And, you know, and I don't want to drink liquor and stick needles in my arms anymore, man. Do you need to tell me how that makes you feel, and what can I do to make this right? And, you know, the book talks about, like, it's easier to go to an enemy than a friend, right? Like, you know, take the bit in our teeth. And he starts to have some conversations back with me, and a lot of healing happens in that moment. And the next day, I have to go with my Kern's mom to get his learner's permit. And so now I get to make amends to her. And I try to make amends for not being present. And she said, Jay, you weren't a bad husband. You just weren't there. She goes, you know what you can do to make it right? Be there for Kirsten. Be there for her. Be there for these kids. Just keep doing what you're doing. I love you, and I'm proud of you. And, man, I keep plugging along, and the kind of gifts of recovery keep happening. There's a couple of mentors of mine in the Atlanta area who are super spiritual and all into this cool meditation stuff. And I find this Buddhist monk in Blythe, Georgia, of all places. It's about 30 miles outside of Augusta. Monk Tom. And I'm going to go meditate with Monk Tom so I can be cool like all my buddies up in Atlanta. And I discover that it's a 3-hour-long meditation. It's like an hour and a half sitting, 20 minutes walking, another 15 minutes sitting. So I do a little more investigating, and I find this church in Augusta called Unity of Augusta. They do a 20-minute meditation on Sunday mornings, and then they have a 20-minute discussion about it afterwards. And I said, man, that's way more my speed. And so I go there, and there's this cute girl in there. We're meditating. I'm like opening my eyes, peeking. And so I go back the next week, right, to see if she's there again, and we start to have some conversations, and we start to hang out, and we form this relationship, and we start this relationship, and it gets to be Christmas time, and I'm like, it's the first Christmas, right, I got to do something romantic. She's not like a real materialistic type person, so, you know, the jewelry and whatever, all that kind of stuff is like, that's not going to do anything. And I'm like, she's kind of recovery minded, she's not one of us, but she's recovery minded, she's a spiritual person. I'm sitting in meditation one morning, and it dawns on me, there's a line in the Big Book that says, we place ourselves in God's hands, the things that come to us are better than anything we could have planned. And I said, you know, that's what happened to me. That's how I met Kirsten. Went to this church to meditate. And so I went out to the Bridges of Hope. I got some, I don't know what kind of paper it is, fancy paper, and typed that quote out and got it framed. And it's hanging next to our bed. And we start this relationship, and we go to buy this house, right? And at the time, I'm working third shift, and she's looking at the house, and the housing market's crazy at the time, right? House goes on the market, it's gone in like 35 seconds, and She calls me one morning, and I told her, I said, look, when the right house shows up, it'll be easy. This is how we'll know it's God's will. It will be easy. God's will is easy. This has just been my experience. And she calls me one morning. I'm like half asleep. She's like, I think I found the house. It's got four bedrooms. All the kids have their own bedrooms. Two baths, fenced in backyard, big addition on the back, la, 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 la. I'm like, calm down. Just can you flip it to FaceTime? Should I put an offer on it? I said, let me show it to you. I'm going to put you on FaceTime. She puts me on FaceTime, and she's in the kitchen. She goes into the other room, and I said, make an offer on the house. She was like, the kids haven't seen it. Nobody's seen it. I said, nobody needs to see it. That's my kid's grandmother's house. Wow. They've been in that house their whole life. And it wasn't her house, but it was the identical floor plan to the house that my children's grandmother lives in. And we made an offer on the house. They accepted the offer. Man, I start to try to heal this relationship with these kids, and I'll tell you a funny story. I take my son one day. He wanted to go paddleboarding up at Lake, at one of the lakes outside of Greenville up near Seneca. And so we're up there, and we got rent life jackets, and we're paddleboarding, and we're having a good time, man. And we get back to the car, and we get back to the, you know, where we're turning in the paddleboards, and he goes, Dad, I lost the life jacket. And I'm like, this damn kid, so irresponsible. What's wrong with you? And I'm kind of pissed, right? Because I'm like, they're probably going to charge me like $50 for this $12 life jacket. You know what I mean? And he smirks like sometimes people will do, like when they get nervous. And I took it like he was laughing at me, like he thought it was funny that I was going to have to spend this $50. I don't realize that God's about to use this money to teach me a lesson. And so I snap at him. I like, bite it. You should be more responsible. Don't smirk at me. This is not funny. And the life jacket was $75, not $50. So now I'm even more pissed. And we're walking to the car, and it's like an hour car ride home, and I'm just like praying, don't be in the now. Don't cuss this kid out. Don't ruin the car ride home. And he goes, and he had already apologized to me and everything. And he said, what's wrong with you? And I said, if you were just a little more responsible and you apologized and you were just had any mind of what it takes to earn money and, you know, doing the dad thing and probably pointing my finger at him. And he said, Dad, your opinion of how sorry I am doesn't determine how sorry I actually am. So I asked him to sponsor me. I was telling a buddy of mine that story, one of the guys I sponsor, and he said, where do you think he learned stuff like that? And I said, man, the kid grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was cool with that. I was cool with that as the reason, right? And I was telling another guy that I sponsored that same story, and he said, maybe he learned it because you're his dad. And I had never considered that. And so, man, we start to heal these relationships, and things are great, and life is going good. And this week has been a tough week at home where I'm supposed to practice these principles. And the best I could do at my house this week was just shut up, right? I wasn't really keen on, like, let's engage and see what's happening. It was just shut up, lean into my network, hold space. And I got back from this big book study last night, and Kirsten walked in the bedroom, and she said, can I give you a hug? And I said, I wish you would give me a hug. And she gave me a hug, and she said, I apologize for taking my anger out on you this week. And I thought, man, what if I would have just, how bad would it have been in my house if I had just opened my mouth and said some of the stuff that was going on in my head, right? Thank God I got you people to say some of that stuff too. I don't always need to say everything to everybody. And man, we have this great relationship. Most mornings we read together and foster this relationship. She's joined the Al-Anon Fellowship, and so now I got a mom and a significant other in that deal, and that's Old Al-Anons. You know how many Al-Anons it takes to screw in a light bulb? None. They just sit back and watch it screw itself. Good thing about being in love with the Al-Anon is we're in love with the same person. There's one thing that my dad asked me to do in his will. Because we healed that relationship in sobriety, there was one thing that he asked me to do in his will that I haven't done yet, and he passed away 5 years ago. And it's to take his ashes to Louisville, Kentucky, and spread them in Cave Hill Cemetery with his six-year-old brother who died of polio. And my little brother is named after his little brother. And so I was sitting in meditation the other morning, and I was thinking, the thought came to me, man, I should find out when Hugh Roger, who would have been my uncle, when his birthday was, and take the ashes up there this year on his birthday and spread them on his birthday. So I called my mom after I got done with just sitting, and I said, hey, can you find out when Hugh Roger's birthday is? I want to take Dad's ashes up to Louisville, and I think I'm going to do it on Hugh Roger's birthday this year. And she said, yeah, I can find out for you. I don't know when it is, but let me find out for you. She called me back, and she said his birthday was June 10th. And I said, oh, man, that's not really a surprise. Wow, that's the day AA was founded. So on June 10th of this year, me and my brother are going to be in Louisville, Kentucky, spreading our dad's ashes with his little brother and kind of completing that circle. I'm going to get to go to his old home group. June 10th happens to be on a Friday night this year, his home group where I got to talk five or six times before he passed away. I'm going to go get to see some old friends up there, and that's going to be a good experience. You know, I always try to have a few guys in the beginning part of the work. I'm currently sponsoring, I don't know, five or six guys, and I'm working with the guy currently right now out in Springfield, Illinois. And we do it all on Zoom, and it works fine. And this guy's super excited, and he's all gung-ho about recovery. And he's 6 months sober, and he calls me the other day. And one of the ways that I operate with amends is just kind of the way I was taught. We're going to write everything on note cards. We're going to use a plus-minus system. Plus-plus, you're ready to go make it. Plus-minus, you're ready to make it, but you don't know where they are. Minus-plus, you're not going to make it, and you know where they are. And minus-minus, you're not going to make it and you don't know where they are. And so he's got his little piles separated. And he said, man, I just don't know where to start. And I said, well, you owe any amends to anybody in that house you're sitting in right now? And he was like, well, just everybody under this roof. And I said, well, why don't you start there? His wife's 20 years sober. He's like 6 months sober. I said, she's going to know what you're getting at, man. Why don't you start with Annie? And he called me the other day, and he said, "I'm gonna make amends to my children's mom, to my ex-wife today." And he said, "I'm nervous." And he said, "I'm so nervous. I'm just gonna spring it on her when I drop our daughter off." And I said, "No, you're not. It's a terrible idea. You need to tell her exactly what you want to talk to her about, or you're gonna owe another amends by the time you're done making this one." And man, and he called me back, and he was just, he couldn't put into words the experience he had cleaning up the past with this woman. And so he's on fire, and that's exciting to watch. And then I got another guy who wants me to sponsor him, and I'm not a call me every day sponsor kind of guy. Not your daddy. I don't know who you should date. I don't know what job you should take. I can't even manage my own life. I sure as hell ain't gonna try to manage yours. And but there's this young kid in Augusta, and he asked me to sponsor him, and I said, why don't you just start by calling me every day? He's like 19 years old. And he called yesterday, called again this morning. He was on his way to a job interview. And I said, hey, Jesse, tell me what's going on, man. Like, let's get real. And there was a pause, right? So I knew he's about to lie. And he said, man, I just went and took this drug test for this job. And I've been clean for a while, but I just ate some pills. And I said, okay, I'm going to call somebody. I'm out of town. I'm going to call somebody. I'm going to get you to meet them at a meeting tonight if you're willing to do that. And so we'll see how that plans out. But I'm a big believer in sitting down eye to eye, whether Zoom to Zoom, modem to modem, face to face, right? A, speak the language of the heart. CA, speak the language of the heart. And that's one of my favorite lines in the book. And We're going to read all the words in the first 164 pages of the big book. And when it says to do something, we're going to do it. And we're going to follow the cadence of the big book, right? Next, launched, vigorous action, right? We're going to do that. There's a time frame in this stuff, right? They could have used any words in the English language when they wrote the big book, and they chose the words that are in here. So I pay attention to stuff like that when it says next, right? And like in the right before the third step prayer where it says like this power would provide what we needed if means there's a condition, right? And so I have to do all those things. And I would not trade the 3.5 years I have sober for the 10 years that I had before. Most of the guys that asked me to help them today are guys who had a bunch of time sober and they don't have it anymore. Right?
Right.
Funny how that works. I actually got some experience to help them with that. And what I know about that to be true in my life, right, is when that suffering that I experienced from that 6-year-long relapse has some purpose, the suffering stopped. Right? Tell you one more story real quick, and then I'm sit down and shut up. So some years ago, and this story that I'm about to tell you sums up my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and with the 12 steps. And it's about this, it's a story about the Special Olympics in Seattle, Washington. It's where they were having the Special Olympics this year. And there were 10 kids about to run the 100-yard dash. And they start to run the 100-yard dash, right? And they get, there's like 9 of them at like the 70-yard mark. And there's this one kid, and he's got Down syndrome, and he's back at like the 30-yard mark. And he falls, and he busts his knee open really, really bad. And he's bleeding, and he's crying. And the other kids hear him, and they stop. And they all turn around, and they go back to the 30-yard mark where this kid is. And one of the little girls leans down and she rubs the blood off and she kisses his knee and they stand him up and they lock arms with him and they say, come on, you can finish the race with us. And they all walk and finish the race together. And you see, that's what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's exactly what the big book talks about on page 153. I fell down and you guys came back and you picked me up and you dusted me off. And you said, it's going to be okay. Come walk with us. And you showed me what it is to give of your life so someone else could live. So thank you for my life.